the trouble.
Bug, said Locke, you'll...
If you don't like it, you'll have to lock me in a box to stop me. You need a spotter, and the Grey King didn't say you couldn't have friends lurking. That's what I do. I lurk. None of you can do it like I can, because you're all bigger and slower and creakier and...
Gods, said Locke, my days as a garrista are numbered. Duke Bug is dictating the terms of his service. Very well, Your Grace. I'll give you a role that will keep you close at hand, but you lurk where I tell you to lurk, right?
Bloody right!
Then it's settled, said Locke. And if no one else has a pressing need for me to imitate the great and powerful, or a friend of mine they'd like to murder, I could use some sleep. It's too goddamned bad about Nazca, said Galdo. This son of a bitch. Yes, said Locke. In fact, I'm going to speak to him about it this very evening. Him or his pet sorcerer, whichever thinks to come. The candle, said Jean. Yeah. After you and I finish our business, and after false light, you can wait down in the last mistake. I'll sit up here, light it, and wait for them to show. Locke grinned. Let those fuckers enjoy the walk up our stairs. 3. The day turned out clear and pleasant, the evening as fresh as they ever came in Camor. Locke sat in the 7th-floor rooms with the windows open and the mesh screens down as the purple sky lit up with rising streamers of ghostly light. The falconer's candle smouldered on the table beside the remains of Locke's small dinner and a half-empty bottle of wine. The other half of that bottle was warming Locke's stomach as he sat, facing the door, massaging the fresh dressing Jean had insisted on wrapping his arm with before taking up his post in the last mistake. "Crooked Warden," said Locke to thin air, "if I'm pissing you off for some reason, you don't need to go to such elaborate lengths to chastise me. And if I'm not pissing you off, well, I pray that you still find me amusing." He flexed the fingers of his injured arm, wincing, then took up his wine glass and the bottle one more time. "A glass poured to air for an absent friend," he said as he filled it with dark red wine, a Nakotsa Retsina that had actually come from Don Salvara's upriver vineyards, a gift to Lucas Fairwhite as he stepped off the Don's pleasure barge so many days earlier, or not so many days earlier. It felt like a lifetime. "We miss Nazca Barsavi already, and we wish her well. She was a fair garista, and she tried to help her peasant out of an untenable situation for them both. She deserved better. Piss on me all you like, but do what you can for her. I beg this as your servant."
"If you wish to measure a man's true penitence," said the falconer, "observe him when he believes himself to be dining alone."
The front door was just closing behind the bondsmage. Locke had not seen or heard it open. For that matter, it had been bolted. The falconer was without his bird, and dressed in the same wide-skirted grey coat with silver-buttoned scarlet cuffs Locke had seen the night before. A grey velvet cap was tilted back atop his head, adorned with a single feather under a silver pin, easily identified as having come from Vestris.
"I, for one, have never been a very penitent man," he continued, "nor have I ever been overly fond of stairs."
"My heart is overcome with sorrow for your hardship," said Locke. "Where's your hawk?"
"Circling."
Locke was suddenly acutely aware of the open windows, such a comfort just a moment earlier. The mesh wouldn't keep Vestris out if the hawk decided to be unruly. "I'd hoped that your master might come along with you."
"My client," said the bondsmage, "is otherwise occupied. I speak for him, and I will bear your words to him, assuming you have any worth hearing."
"I always have words," said Locke. "Words like complete lunatic and fucking idiot. Did it ever occur to you or your client that the one certain way to ensure that a Camorri would never negotiate with you with any good faith
would be to kill someone of his blood.
Heavens, said the falconer, this is ill news indeed. And here the Grey King was so certain Barsavi would interpret his daughter's murder as a friendly gesture.
The sorcerer's eyebrows rose.
I say, did you want to tell him yourself, or shall I rush off right now with your revelation?
Very funny, you half-copper cocksucker. While I agreed under duress to prance around dressed as your master, you must admit that sending the copper's only daughter back to him in a vat of piss does complicate my fucking job.
A pity, said the bondsmage. But the task remains, as does the duress.
Barsavi wants me by his side at this meeting, Falconer. He made the request this morning. Maybe I might have slipped out of it before, but now? Nazca's murder has put me in a hell of a squeeze.
You're the Thorn of Camor. I would be personally very disappointed if you couldn't find a way past this difficulty. Barsavi's summons is a request. My client's is a requirement.
Your client isn't telling me everything he should.
You may safely presume that he knows his own business better than you do.
The falconer began to idly wind a slender thread back and forth between the fingers of his right hand. It had an odd silver sheen.
"Gods damn it!"
Locke hissed. "Maybe I don't care what happens to the copper, but Nazca was my friend. Duress I can accept. Gleeful malice I cannot. You fuckers didn't need to do what you did to her." The falconer splayed his fingers and the thread gleamed, woven into a sort of cat's cradle. He began to move his fingers slowly, tightening some threads and loosening others, as deftly as the Sansas moved coins across the backs of their hands.
"I cannot tell you," said the sorcerer, "what a weight it is upon my conscience to learn that we might lose your gracious acceptance."
Then the falconer hissed a word, a single syllable in a language Locke didn't understand. The very sound was harsh and unnerving. It echoed in the room as though heard from a distance. The wood shutters behind Locke slammed closed, and he jumped out of his chair. One by one the other windows banged shut, and their little clasps clicked, moved by an unseen hand. The falconer shifted his fingers yet again. Light gleamed on the web within his hands, and Locke gasped. His knees suddenly ached as though they'd been kicked from the sides, sharply.
"This is the second time," said the bondsmage, "that you have been flippant with me. I fail to find it amusing. So I will reinforce my client's instructions, and I shall take my time doing so."
Locke gritted his teeth. Tears sprang unbidden to his eyes as the pain in his legs intensified, throbbed, spread. It now felt as though a cold flame were playing against his knee sockets from the inside. Unable to support his own weight, he tottered forward. One hand clutched helplessly at his legs, while the other tried to hold him up against the table. He glared at the bondsmage and tried to speak, but found that the muscles of his neck began spasming as he did.
"You are property, Lamora. You belong to the Grey King. He cares not that Nazca Barsavi was your friend. It was her ill fortune to be born to the father the gods gave her."
The spasming spread down Locke's spine, across his arms and down his legs, where it met the freezing, gnawing pain already at work there in a hideous fusion. He fell onto his back, gasping, his face a rictus mask, his hands curved in the air above his head like claws.
"You look like an insect thrown into a fire, and this is the merest exercise of my art. The things I could do to you if I were to stitch your true name into cloth or scribe it on parchment. Lamora is obviously not your given name. It's Throne Therin for shadow. But your first name, now that would be just enough to master you, if I wished to make use of it."
The falconer's fingers flew back and forth, blurring in Locke's vision. shifting and stretching those silver threads, and the tempo of Locke's torment rose in direct proportion to the motion of that gleaming design. His heels were slapping against the floor. His teeth were rattling in his jaw. It seemed to him that someone was trying to cut the bones out of his thighs with icicles. Again and again he tried to suck in enough air to scream, but his lungs would not move. His throat was packed with thorns, and the world was growing black and red at the edges. Release itself was a shock. He lay on the ground, bonelessly, still feeling the ghosts of pain throbbing across his body. Warm tears slid down his cheeks.
"You're not a particularly intelligent man, Lamora. An intelligent man would never deliberately waste my time. An intelligent man would grasp the nuances of the situation without the need for repetition."
Another motion of blurred silver in the corner of Locke's vision, and new pain erupted in his chest, like a blossom of fire surrounding his heart. He could feel it there, burning the very core of his being. It seemed to him that he could actually smell the crisping flesh within his lungs, and feel the air in his throat warming until it was as hot as that of a bread oven. Locke groaned, writhed, threw his head back, and finally screamed.
"I need you," said the falconer, "but I will have you meek and grateful for my forbearance. Your friends are another matter. Shall I do this to Bug while you watch? Shall I do it to the Sansas?"
"No! Please, no!"
Locke cried out, curled in agony, his hands clutching at his left breast. He found himself tearing at his tunic like an animal mad with pain.
"Not them!"
"Why not? They are immaterial to my client. They are expendable."
The burning pain abated, once again shocking Locke with its absence. He huddled on his side, breathing raggedly, unable to believe that heat so fierce could vanish so swiftly.
"Yes. Yes," said Locke. "Perfectly. Yes. Please don't harm them. I'll do whatever I must."
"Of course you will. Now, I've brought the components of the costume you'll be wearing at the Echo Hole. You'll find them just outside your door. They're appropriately theatrical. I won't presume to tell you how to make ready with your mummery. Be in position across from the Echo Hole at 10:30 on the night of the meeting. I shall guide you from there and direct you in what to say."
"Barsavi," Locke coughed out. "Barsavi will mean to kill me."
"Do you doubt that I could continue punishing you here at my leisure until you were mad with pain?"
"No, no."
"Then do not doubt that I can protect you from whatever nonsense the copper might wish to employ."
How do you mean to direct me?"
"I do not need the air,"
came the voice of the bondsmage, echoing in Locke's head with shocking force,
"to carry forth my instructions. When you require prompting in your meeting with Barsavi, I shall supply it. When you must make a demand or accept a demand, I shall let you know how to proceed. Is this clear?"
"Yes, perfectly clear. Thank you."
"You should be grateful for what my client and I have done on your behalf. Many men wait years for a chance to ingratiate themselves with Kappa Barsavi. Your chance has been served forth to you like a fine meal. Are we not generous?"
"Yes, certainly."
"Just so. I suggest you now find some means to extricate yourself from the duty he asks of you. This will leave you free to concentrate on the duty we require. We wouldn't want your attention divided at a critical moment."
4. The last mistake was half empty, a phenomenon Locke had never before witnessed. Conversation was muted. Eyes were cold and hard. Entire gangs were conspicuous by their absence. Men and women alike wore heavier clothing than the season required, more half-cloaks and coats and layered vests. It was easier to conceal weapons that way.
So what the hell happened to you?
Jean helped Locke sit down. He'd gotten them a small table in a side cranny of the tavern, with a clear view of the doors. Locke settled into his chair, a slight echo of the falconer's phantom pain still haunting his joints and his neck muscles.
The falconer, Locke said in a low voice, had several opinions he wished to express, and apparently I'm not as charming as I think I am.
He idly fingered his torn tunic and sighed.
Beer now, bitch later.
Jean slid over a clay mug of warm Komori ale, and Locke drank half of it down in two gulps.
Well, he said after wiping his mouth, I suppose it was worth it just to say what I said to him. I don't believe Bonds Major are used to being insulted.
Did you accomplish anything?
No.
Locke drank the remaining half of his ale and turned the mug upside down before setting it on the tabletop.
Not a god's damned thing. I did get the shit tortured out of myself, though, which was informational from a certain point of view.
That fucker. Jean's hands balled into fists. I could do so much to him without killing him. I very much hope I get to try.
Save it for the Grey King, muttered Locke. My thoughts are that if we survive what's coming on Duke's Day night, he won't be able to keep the Falconer on retainer forever. When the Bondsmage leaves, we talk to the Grey King again, with knives.
Too right. We follow him if we have to. We've been needing something to do with all of our money. Here's something. Whenever that bastard can't pay his mage any more, we'll show him just how much we like being knocked around like handballs. Even if we have to follow him down the Arn Sea and around the Cape of Nessek and all the way to Balinel on the Sea of Brass.
Now there's a plan. And what are you going to do tonight?
Tonight? Locke grunted. I'm going to take Carlo's advice. I'm going to stroll over to the Gilded Lilies and get my brains wrenched out. They can put them back in the morning when they're through with me. I understand there's an extra fee involved, but I'll pay it.
I must be going mad, said Jean. It's been 4 years, and all this time you've been...
I'm frustrated and I need a break, and she's 1,000 miles away, and I guess I'm human after all, gods damn it. Don't wait up.
I'll walk with you, said Jean. It's not wise to be out alone on a night like this. The city's in a mood now that word of Nazca's got around.
Not wise? Locke laughed. I'm the safest man in Camor, Jean. I know for a fact I'm the only one that absolutely nobody out there wants to kill yet. Not until they've finished pulling my strings.
5. This isn't working, he said, less than 2 hours later. I'm sorry, it's not your fault.
The room was warm and dark and exceedingly pleasant, ventilated by the soft swish of a wooden fan flapping back and forth in a concealed shaft. Water wheels churned outside the ornate house of the Gilded Lilies at the northern tip of the snare, driving belts and chains to operate many mechanisms of comfort. Locke lay on a wide bed with soft feather mattresses covered in silk sheets and overhung with a silk canopy. He sprawled naked in the soft red light of a misted alchemical globe, little stronger than scarlet moonlight, and admired the soft curves of the woman who was running her hands along the insides of his thighs. She smelled like mulled apple wine and cinnamon musk, and her curves were indeed admirable, yet he was nothing resembling aroused.
"Felice, please," he said. "This was a bad idea."
"You're tense," whispered Felice. "You've obviously got something on your mind, and that cut on your arm, it can't be helping at all. Let me try a few things more. I'm always up for a professional challenge."
"I can't imagine anything would help."
Locke could hear the pout in her voice, though her face was little more than soft slashes of shadow in the red half-light.
There's wines, you know, alchemical ones from Talvarar, aphrodisiacs. Not cheap, but they do work.
She rubbed his stomach, toying with the slender line of hair that ran down its center.
They can work miracles.
I don't need wine, he said distantly, grabbing her hand and moving it away from his chin. Gods, I don't know what I need.
Allow me to make a suggestion, then.
She moved herself up on the bed until she was crouched beside his chest, on her knees. With one confident motion, for there was real muscle under those curves, she flipped him over onto his stomach and began kneading the muscles of his neck and back, alternating gentle caresses and firm pressure.
Suggestion, ow, accepted.
Locke,
Felice said, losing the breathy anything-to-please-you bedroom voice that was one of the cherished illusions of her trade.
You do know that the attendants in the waiting chambers tell us exactly what each client requests when they give us assignments.
So I've heard.
Well, I know you specifically asked for a redhead.
Which...
Ow! Lower, please.
Which means...
There's only two of us in the Lilies, she said, and we get that request every now and again. But the thing is, some men want any redhead in general, and some men want one redhead in particular.
Oh.
Those that want a redhead in general have their fun and go their way, but you... You want one redhead in particular, and I'm not her.
I'm sorry, I said it's not your fault.
I know, that's ever so gracious of you.
And I'm happy paying anyways.
And that's also sweet, she chuckled. But you'd be taking it up with the room full of armed men if you didn't, not just worrying about hurting my poor feelings.
You know, Locke said, I think I prefer you like this to all that, how may I please you, master, bullshit earlier.
Well, some men like a straightforward whore. Some don't want to hear anything but how wonderful they are.
She worked at his neck muscles with the bases of her palms.
It's all business. But like I said, you seem to be pining for someone. And now that you've remembered yourself, I won't do.
Sorry.
No need to keep apologizing to me. You're the one whose lady love ran halfway across the continent.
Gods, Locke groaned. Find me a single person in Camor who doesn't know, and I'll give you 100 crowns, I swear.
It's just something I heard from one of the Sansas.
One of the Sansas? Which one?
Couldn't say. They're so hard to tell apart in the dark.
I'm going to cut their god's damned tongues out.
Oh, tch. She ruffled his hair. Please don't. Us girls have a use for those, at least.
Hmm.
You poor sweet idiot. You do have it bad for her. Well, what can I say, Locke? You're fucked.
Felice laughed softly.
Just not by me.
Interlude. Brat Masterpieces. 1. The summer after Jean came to the Gentleman Bastards, Father Chains took him and Locke up to the temple roof one night after dinner. Chains smoked a paper-wrapped sheaf of Jeremite tobacco, while the sunlight sank beneath the horizon, and the court fire of the city's elderglass rose glimmering in its place. That night he wanted to talk about the eventual necessity of cutting throats.
I had this talk with Carlo and Galdo and Sabatha last year, he began. You boys are investments, in time and treasure both.
He exhaled ragged crescents of pale smoke, failing as usual to conjure full rings.
Big investments, my life's work, maybe. A pair of brat masterpieces. So I want you to remember that you can't always smile your way around a fight. If someone pulls steel on you, I expect you to survive. Sometimes that means giving back in kind. Sometimes it means running like your ass is on fire. Always it means knowing which is the right choice. And that's why we've got to talk about your inclinations.
Chains fixed Locke with a stare while he took a long, deliberate drag on his sheaf, the final breath of a man treading in unpleasant water, preparing to go under the surface. "You and I both know that you have multiple talents, Locke, genuine gifts for a great many things. So I have to give this to you straight. If it comes down to hard talk with a real foe, you're nothing but a pair of pissed breeches and a bloodstain. You can kill, all right. That's the God's own truth. But you're just not made for stand-up, face-to-face bruising. And you know it, right?" Locke's red-cheeked silence was an answer in itself. Suddenly unable to look Father Chains in the eyes, he tried to pretend that his feet were fascinating objects that he'd never seen before. "Locke, Locke, we can't all be mad dogs with a blade in our hands, and it's nothing to sob about, so let's not see that lip of yours quivering like an old whore's tits, right? You will learn steel, and you'll learn rope, and you'll learn the alley piece, but you'll learn them sneak style. In the back, from the side, from above, in the dark." Chains grabbed an imaginary opponent from behind, left hand round the throat, right hand thrusting at kidney level with his half-smoked sheaf for a dagger. "All the twists, because fighting wisely will keep you from getting cut to mince." Chains pretended to wipe the blood from his ember-tipped blade, then took another drag. "That's that. Put it in your hat and wear it to town, Locke. We need to face our shortcomings head on. The old saying for a gang is, lies go out, but the truth stays home." He forced twin streams of smoke from his nostrils and cheered up visibly as the tails of grey vapour swirled around his head. "Now quit acting like there's a fucking naked woman on your shoes, will you?" Locke did grin at that, weakly, but he also looked up and nodded. "Now you," Chains said, turning to regard Jean. "We all know you've got the sort of temper that cracks skulls when it's off the leash. We've got a properly evil brain in Locke here, a fantastic liar. Carlo and Galdo are silver at all trades and gold at none. Sabatha's the born queen of all the charmers that ever lived. But what we don't have yet is a plain old bruiser. I think it could be you, a stand-up brawler to keep your friends out of trouble. A real rabid dog bastard with steel in your hand. Care to give it a go?" Jean's eyes were immediately drawn down to the fascinating spectacle of his own feet.
Well, if you think that would be good, I can try."
"Jean, I've seen you angry."
"I felt you angry," said Locke, grinning.
"And give me some credit for being 5 times your fucking age, Jean. You don't smoulder and you don't make threats, you just go cold. And then you make things happen. Some folks are made for hard situations."
He drew smoke from his sheaf once again and flicked white ashes to the stones beneath his feet.
"I think you have the knack for smacking brains out of heads. That's neither good nor bad in itself, but it's something we can use."
Jean seemed to think this over for a few moments, but Locke and Chains could both see the decision already made in his eyes. They had gone hard and hungry under his black tangle of hair, and his nod was just a formality.
"Good, good. Thought you'd like the idea, so I took the liberty of making arrangements."
He produced a black leather wallet from one of the pockets of his coat and handed it over to Jean.
12:30 tomorrow. You're expected at the House of Glass Roses."
Locke and Jean both widened their eyes at the mention of Camors' best-known and most exclusive school of arms. Jean flipped the sigil wallet open. Inside was a flat token, a stylized rose in frosted glass fused directly onto the inner surface of the leather. With this, Jean could pass north over the Angevine and past the guard posts to the Alchigrante Islands. It placed him under the direct protection of Don Tomsa Maranzala, master of the House of Glass Roses. "That rose will get you over the river and up among the swells, but don't fuck around once you're up there. Do what you're told. Go straight there and come straight back. You go 4 times a week from now on, and for all our sakes, tame that mess on top of your head. Use fire and a poleaxe if you have to." Chains took a final drag of evergreen-scented smoke from his rapidly disappearing sheaf, then flicked the butt up and over the roof wall. His last exhalation of the night sailed over the heads of the two boys, a wobbly but otherwise fully formed ring.
"Fuck me, an omen."
Chains reached after the drifting ring as though he could pluck it back for examination.
"Either this scheme is fated to work out, or the gods are pleased with me for engineering your demise, Jean Tannen. I love a win-win proposition. Now don't you two have work to do?"
2. In the House of Glass Roses, there was a hungry garden. The place was Camor in microcosm, a thing of the Eldrin left behind for men to puzzle over, a dangerous treasure discarded like a toy. The elderglass that mortared its stones rendered it proof against all human arts, much like the 5 towers and 12 other structures scattered over the islands of the city. The men and women who lived in these places were squatters in glory, and the House of Glass Roses was the most glorious, dangerous place on the Alchigrante slopes. That Don Maranzala held it was a sign of his high and lasting favour with the Duke. Just before the midpoint of the noon hour the next day, Jean Tannen stood at the door of Don Maranzala's tower. 5 cylindrical stories of grey stone and silver glass, a hulking fastness that made the lovely villas around it look like an architect's scale models. Great waves of white heat beat down from the cloudless sky, and the air was heavy with the slightly beery breath of a city river boiling under long hours of sun. A frosted glass window was set into the stone beside the tower's huge, lacquered oaken doors, behind which the vague outline of a face could be discerned. Jean's approach had been noted. He'd gone north over the Angevine on a glass catbridge no wider than his hips, clinging to the guide ropes with sweaty hands for all 600 feet of the crossing. There were no large bridges to the south bank of the Isla Zantara, second most easterly of the Alchigrante Islands. Ferry rides were a copper half-baron. For those too poor to ride, that left the ecstatic terror of the cat bridges. Jean had never been aloft on one before, and the sight of more experienced men and women ignoring the ropes as they crossed at speed had turned his bowels to ice water. The feel of hard pavement beneath his shoes had been a blessed relief when it came again. The sweat-soaked yellow jackets on duty at the Isla Zantara gatehouse had let Jean pass far more quickly than he'd thought possible, and he'd seen the mirth drain from their ruddy faces the moment they recognized the sigil he carried. Their directions after that had been terse. Was it pity that tinged their voices, or fear?
"We'll look for you, boy!"
one of them suddenly called after him as he started up the clean white stones of the street.
"If you come back down the hill again!"
Mingled pity and fear, then. Had Jean really been enthusiastic for this adventure as recently as the night before? The creak and rattle of counterweights heralded the appearance of a dark crack between the twin doors before him. A second later, the portal swung wide with slow majesty, muscled outward by a pair of men in blood-red waistcoats and sashes, and Jean saw that each door was 1/2 foot of solid wood backed with iron bands. A wave of scents washed out over him, humid stone and old sweat, roasting meat and cinnamon incense, smells of prosperity and security, of life within walls. Jean held his wallet up to the men who'd opened the door, and one of them waved a hand impatiently.
"You're expected. Enter as a guest of Don Maranzala and respect his house as you would your own."
Against the left-hand wall of the opulent foyer, a pair of curlicue staircases in black iron wound upward.
Jean followed the man around and up one set of narrow steps, self-consciously trying to keep his sweating and gasping under control. The tower doors were pulled shut beneath them with an echoing slam. They wound their way up past three floors of glittering glass and ancient stone, decorated with thick red carpets and innumerable stained tapestries that Jean recognized as battle flags. Don Maranzala had served as the Duke's personal swordmaster and the commander of his black jackets for a quarter of a century. These bloody scraps of cloth were all that remained of countless companies of men fate had thrown against Nicovante and Maranzala in fights that were now legend. The Iron Sea Wars, the Mad Count's Rebellion, the Thousand-Day War against Tal Verar. At last, the winding stair brought them up into a small, dim room, barely larger than a closet, lit by the gentle red glow of a paper lantern. The man placed one hand on a brass knob and turned to look down at Jean. "This is the garden without fragrance," he said. "Step with care and touch nothing as you love life." Then he pushed the door to the roof open, letting in a sight so bright and astounding that Jean rocked backward on his heels. The house of glass roses was more than twice as wide as it was tall, so the roof must have been at least 100 feet in diameter, walled in on all sides. For a frightful moment, Jean thought he stood before a blazing 100-hued alchemical fire. All the stories and rumors had done nothing to prepare him for the sight of this place beneath the full light of a white summer sun. It seemed as though liquid diamond pulsed through a million delicate veins and scintillated on a million facets and edges. Here was an entire rose garden, wall after wall of perfect petals and stems and thorns, silent and scentless and alive with reflected fire, for it was all carved from elderglass, 100,000 blossoms perfect down to the tiniest thorn. Dazzled, Jean stumbled forward and stretched out a hand to steady himself. When he forced his eyes closed, the darkness was alive with afterimages like flashes of heat lightning. Don Maranzala's man caught him by the shoulders, gently but firmly.
"It can be overwhelming at first. Your eyes will adjust in a few moments, but mark my words well, and by the gods, touch nothing."
As Jean's eyes recovered from the initial shock of the garden, he began to see past the dazzling glare. Each wall of roses was actually transparent. The nearest was just 2 paces away, and it was flawless as the rumors claimed, as though the Eldrin had frozen every blossom and every bush in an instant of summer's fullest perfection. Yet there were patches of genuine color here and there in the hearts of the sculptures, swirled masses of reddish-brown translucence, like clouds of rust-colored smoke frozen in ice. These clouds of color were human blood. Every petal, leaf, and thorn was sharper than any razor. The merest touch would open human skin like paper, and the roses would drink, or so the stories said, siphoning blood deep inside the network of glass stems and vines. Presumably, if enough lives were fed to the garden, every blossom and every wall would some day turn a rich, rusty red. Some rumors had it that the garden merely drank what was spilled upon it. Others claimed that the roses would actually draw blood forth from a wound and could drain a man white from any cut, no matter how small. It would take intense concentration to walk through these paths. Most were only 2 or 3 paces wide, and a moment of distraction could be deadly. It said much about Don Maranzala that he thought of his garden as the ideal place to teach young men how to fight. For the first time, Jean felt a sense of dreadful awe at the creatures who'd vanished from Camorre 1,000 years before his birth. How many other alien surprises had they left behind for men to stumble over? What could drive away beings powerful enough to craft something like this? The answer did not bear thinking of. Maranzala's man released his grip on Jean's shoulders and re-entered the dim room at the apex of the stairs. The room, as Jean now saw, jutted out of the tower's wall like a gardener's shack.
"The Don will be waiting at the center of the garden," he said.
Then he pulled the door shut after him, and Jean seemed alone on the roof, with the naked sun overhead and the walls of thirsty glass before him. Yet he wasn't alone. There was noise coming from the heart of the glass garden, the wickering skirl of steel against steel, low grunts of exertion, a few terse commands and a deep voice rich with authority. Just a few minutes earlier, Jean would have sworn that the Catbridge crossing was the most frightening thing he'd ever done, but now that he faced the garden without fragrance, he would have gladly gone back to the midpoint of that slender arch 50 feet above the Angevine and danced on it without guide ropes. Still, the black wallet clutched in his right hand drew his mind to the fact that Father Chains had thought him right for whatever awaited him in this garden. Despite their scintillating danger, the roses were inanimate and unthinking. How could he have the heart of a killer if he feared to walk among them? Shame drove him forward, step by sliding step, and he threaded the twisting paths of the garden with exquisite care, sweat sliding down his face and stinging his eyes. "I am a gentleman bastard," he muttered to himself. It was the longest 30 feet of his brief life, that passage between the cold and waiting walls of roses. He didn't allow them a single taste of him. At the center of the garden was a circular courtyard about 30 feet wide. Here, two boys, roughly Jean's age, were circling one another, rapiers flicking and darting. Another half-dozen boys watched uneasily, along with a tall man of late middle age. This man had shoulder-length hair and drooping moustaches the color of cold campfire ashes. His face was like sanded leather, and though he wore a gentleman's doublet in the same vivid red as the attendants downstairs, he wore it over weather-stained soldier's breeches and tattered field boots. There wasn't a boy at the lesson who didn't put his master's clothes to shame. These were sons of the quality, in brocade jackets and tailored breeches, silk tunics and polished imitations of swordsmen's boots. Each one also wore a white leather buff coat and silver-studded bracers of the same material. Just the thing for warding off thrusts from training weapons. Jean felt naked the instant he stepped into the clearing, and only the threat of the glass roses kept him from leaping back into concealment. One of the duelists was surprised to see Jean emerge from the garden, and his opponent made good use of that split second of inattention. He deftly thrust his rapier into the meat of the first boy's upper arm, punching through the leather. The skewered boy let out an unbecoming holler and dropped his blade.
"My Lord Maranzala!"
One of the boys in the crowd spoke up, and there was more oil in his voice than there was on a blade put away for storage.
"Lorenzo was clearly distracted by the boy who just came out of the garden. That was not a fair strike."
Every boy in the clearing turned to regard Jean, and it was impossible to guess what soonest ignited their naked disdain. His labourer's clothing, his pear-like physique, his lack of weapons and armour. Only the boy with a spreading circle of blood on his tunic sleeve failed to stare at him with open loathing. He had other problems. The grey-haired man cleared his throat, then spoke in the deep voice Jean had heard earlier. He seemed amused.
"You were a fool to take your eyes from your opponent, Lorenzo. So in a sense you earned that sting. But it is true, all things being equal, that a young gentleman should not exploit an outside distraction to score a touch. You will both try to do better next time."
He pointed toward Jean without looking at him, and his voice lost its warmth.
"And you, boy, lose yourself in the garden until we've finished here. I don't want to see you again until these young gentlemen have left."
Certain that the fire rising in his cheeks could outshine the sun itself, Jean rapidly scuttled out of sight. Several seconds passed before he realized with horror that he had leapt back into the maze of sculpted glass walls without hesitation. Positioning himself a few bends back from the clearing, he stood in mingled fear and self-loathing, and tried to hold himself rigid as the sun's heat cooked great rivers of sweat out of him. Fortunately, he hadn't much longer to wait. The sound of steel on steel faded, and Don Maranzalla dismissed his class. They filed past Jean with their coats off and their jackets open, each boy seemingly at ease with the lethal labyrinth of transparent blossoms. Not one said anything to Jean, for this was Don Maranzala's house, and it would be presumptuous of them to chastise a commoner within his domain. The fact that each boy had sweated his silk tunic to near translucency, and that several were red-faced and wobbly with sun-sickness, did little to leaven Jean's misery.
"Boy!"
called the Don after the troop of young gentlemen had passed out of the garden and down the stairs.
"Attend me now!"
Summoning as much dignity as he could, and realizing that most of it was pure imagination, Jean sucked in his wobbling belly and went out into the courtyard once again. Don Maranzalla wasn't facing him. The Don held the undersized training rapier that had recently stung a careless boy's biceps. In his hands it looked like a toy, but the blood that glistened on its tip was quite real.
I'm sorry, sir, my lord Maranzalla. I must have come early. I didn't mean to distract from the lesson.
The Don turned on his heel, smooth as Talvera clockwork, every muscle in his upper body ominously statue-still. He stared down at Jean now, and the cold scrutiny of those black squinting eyes gave Jean the third great scare of the afternoon. He suddenly remembered that he was alone on the roof with a man that had butchered his way into the position he currently held.
"Does it amuse you, lowborn?"
the Don asked in a serpentine whisper.
"To speak before you are spoken to, in a place such as this, to a man such as myself, to a Don?"
Jean's blubbered apology died in his throat with an unmanly choke, the sort of wet noise a clam might make if you broke its shell and squeezed it out through the cracks.
"Because if you're being merely careless, I'll beat that habit out of your butterfat ass before you can blink."
The Don strode over to the nearest wall of glass roses, and with evident care slid the tip of the bloodied rapier into one of the blossoms. Jean watched in horrified fascination as the red stain quickly vanished from the blade and was drawn into the glass, where it diffused into a mist-like pink tendril and was carried into the heart of the sculpture. The Don tossed the clean sword to the ground.
"Is that it? Are you a careless little fat boy, sent up here to pretend at arms? You're a dirty little urchin from the cauldron, no doubt. Some whore's God's damned droppings."
At first the paralysis of Jean's tongue refused to lift. Then he heard the blood pounding in his ears like the crashing of waves on a shore, his fists clenched on some impulse of their own.
"I was born in the north corner," he yelled, "and my mother and father were folk of business."
Almost as soon as he'd finished spitting this out, his heart seemed to stop. Mortified, he put his arms behind his back, bowed his head, and took a step backward. After a moment of weighted silence, Maranzalla laughed loudly and cracked his knuckles with a sound like pine logs popping in a fire.
"You must forgive me, Jean," he said. "I wanted to see if Chains was telling the truth. By the gods, you do have balls and a temper."
"You..."
Jean stared at the Don, comprehension dawning.
"You wanted to make me angry, my lord?"
"I know you're sensitive about your parents, boy. Chains told me quite a bit about you."
The Don knelt on one knee before Jean, bringing them eye to eye, and put a hand on Jean's shoulder.
"Chains isn't blind," said Jean. "I'm not an initiate, and you're not really... not really..."
"A mean son of a bitch."
Jean giggled despite himself.
I wonder if I'll ever meet anyone who is what they seem to be ever again, my lord."
"You have. They walked out of my garden a few minutes ago. And I am a mean son of a bitch, Jean. You're going to hate my miserable old guts before this summer's out. You're going to curse me at false light and curse me at dawn."
"Oh," said Jean, "but That's just business.
Very true, said Don Maranzala. You know, I wasn't born to this place. It was a gift for services rendered. And don't think that I don't value it, but my mother and father weren't even from the North Corner. I was actually born on a farm.
Wow, said Jean.
Yes. Up here in this garden, it won't matter who your parents were. I'll make you work until you sweat blood and plead for mercy. I'll thrash on you until you're inventing new gods to pray to. The only thing this garden respects is concentration. Can you concentrate every moment you're up here? Can you distill your attention, drive it down to the narrowest focus, live absolutely in the now and shut out all other concerns?
I shall have to try, my lord. I already walked through the gardens once. I can do it again.
You will do it again. You'll do it 1,000 times. You'll run through my roses. You'll sleep among them, and you'll learn to concentrate. I warn you, though, some men could not.
The Don arose and swept a hand in a semicircle before him.
You can find what they left behind here and there, in the glass.
Jean swallowed nervously and nodded.
Now, you tried to apologize before for coming early. Truth is, you didn't. I let my previous lesson run long because I tend to indulge those wretched little shits when they want to cut each other up a bit. In future, come at the stroke of one to make sure they're long gone. They cannot be allowed to see me teaching you.
Once, Jean had been the son of substantial wealth, and he had worn clothes as fine as any just seen on this rooftop. What he felt now was the old sting of his loss, he told himself, and not mere shame for anything as stupid as his hair or his clothes or even his hanging belly. This thought was just self-importantly noble enough to keep his eyes dry and his face composed.
I understand, my lord. I don't wish to embarrass you again.
Embarrass me? Jean, you misunderstand.
Maranzala kicked idly at the toy rapier, and it clattered across the tiles of the rooftop.
Those prancing little pants-wetters come here to learn the colourful and gentlemanly art of fencing, with its many sporting limitations and its prescriptions against dishonourable engagements. You, on the other hand, he said as he turned to give Jean a firm but friendly poke in the centre of his forehead, you are going to learn how to kill men with a sword.
Chapter 7. Out the Window. 1. Locke outlined his plan over a long, nervous lunch. The gentleman bastards sat at the dining table in their glass burrow, just after noon on Duke's Day. Outside, the sun was pouring down its usual afternoon punishment, but in the burrow it was cool, perhaps unnaturally so, even for an underground cellar. Chains had often speculated that the elderglass did tricks with more than just light. They had laid on a feast more befitting a festival than a midday meeting. There was stewed mutton with onions and ginger, stuffed eels in spiced wine sauce, and green apple tarts baked by Jean, with a liberal dose of Osterschalen brandy poured over the fruit. I'll bet even the Duke's own cook would have his balls skinned if he did this, he'd said. Makes each tart worth 2 or 3 crowns, by my reckoning.
What'll they be worth, said Bug, once they're eaten and they come out the other end?
You're welcome to take measurements, said Carlo. Grab a scale.
And a scoop, added Galdo.
The Sunzas spent the meal picking at a seasoned omelette topped with minced sheep's kidneys, usually a favourite with the whole table. But today, though they all agreed it was their best effort in weeks, topping even the celebration of their first success in the Salvara game, the savour seemed to have evaporated. Only Bug ate with real vigour, and his attention was largely concentrated on Jean's plate of tarts.
"Look at me," he said with his mouth half full. "I'm worth more with every bite."
Quiet half-smiles met his clowning, and nothing more.
The boy harrumphed in annoyance and banged his fists on the table.
"Well, if none of you want to eat," he said, "why don't we get on with planning how we're going to dodge the axe tonight?"
"Indeed," said Jean. "Too right," added Carlo.
"Yes," said Galdo.
"What's the game and how do we play it?" "Well," Locke pushed his plate away, crumpled his cloth napkin, and threw it into the center of the table. "For starters, we need to use the damn broken tower rooms again. It seems the stairs aren't through with us just yet."
Jean nodded. "What will we do with the place?"
"That's where you and I will be when Andres comes looking to collect us at the ninth hour. And that's where we'll stay after he's thoroughly convinced that we have a very honest reason for not going with him."
"What reason would that be?" asked Carlo.
"A very colourful one," said Locke. "I need you and Galdo to pay a quick visit to Jessaline Dorbar this afternoon. I need help from a black alchemist for this. Here's what you tell her." 2. The illicit apothecary shop of Jessaline Dorbar and her daughter Janelaine was located above a scribe's collective in the respectable Fountain Bend neighborhood. Carlo and Galdo stepped onto the scribing floor at just past the second hour of the afternoon. Here a dozen men and women were hunched over wide wooden boards, working quills and salt and charcoal sticks, and drying sponges back and forth like automatons. A clever arrangement of mirrors and skylights let the natural light of day in to illuminate their work. There were few tradesfolk in Camor more penny-conscious than journeyman scriveners. At the rear of the first floor was a winding staircase, guarded by a tough-looking young woman who feigned boredom while fingering weapons beneath her brocaded brown coat. The Sansa twins established their bona fides with a combination of hand gestures and copper barons that made their way into the young woman's coat pockets. She tugged on a bell rope beside the stairs, then waved them up. On the second floor there was a reception room, windowless, walls and floor alike panelled with a golden hardwood that retained a faint aroma of pine lacquer. A tall counter divided the room precisely in half. There were no chairs on the customer side, and nothing at all on display on the merchant's side, just a single locked door. Jessaline stood behind the counter, a striking woman in her mid-50s, with a tumbling cascade of charcoal-coloured hair and dark, wary eyes nestled in laugh lines. Janelaine, half her age, stood to her mother's right with a crossbow pointed just over Carlo and Galdo's heads. It was an indoor murder piece, lightweight and low power, which almost certainly meant some hideous poison on the quarrel. Neither Sansa was particularly bothered. This was business as usual for a black alchemist.
"Madame Dobar and Miss Dobar," said Carlo, bowing from the waist, "your servants." "Not to mention," said Galdo, "still very much available."
"Master Sansa and Master Sansa," said the elder Dobar, "pleased to see you." "Although we are," said Janelaine, "still very much disinclined." "Perhaps you'd care to buy something, though?"
Jessaline folded her hands on the counter and raised one eyebrow.
"As it happens, a friend of ours needs something special."
Carlo fished a coin purse from under his waistcoat and held it in plain view without opening it.
"Special?"
"Or perhaps not so much special as specific. He's got to get sick. Very sick."
"Far be it from me to drive away business, my dears," said the elder Dobar. "But 3 or 4 bottles of rum would do the trick at a fraction of the price for anything I could give you."
"Ah, not that sort of sick," said Galdo. "He's got to be in a bad way, like to knocking on Death Goddess' bedchamber and asking if he can come in. And then he's got to be able to recover his strength after playing ill for a while. A sort of mummer's sick, if you will."
"Hmm," said Janelaine. "I don't know if we have anything that works quite like that, at least not on hand." "When," said Jessaline, "would your friend require a solution by?"
"We were sort of hoping to walk out of here with one," said Carlo.
"We don't brew miracles, my dears.
Jessalyn drummed her fingers on her countertop. Contrary to all common belief, we do prefer a bit of notice for something like this. Messing about with someone's inside, fit to ill and then fit again in the span of a few hours, well, that's delicate. We're not bonds, Magi, added Jenelaine.
Praise the gods for that, said Galdo, but it's very pressing.
Well, sighed Jessalyn, perhaps we can bang something together. A bit on the crude, but it might do the trick. Barrel robber's blossom, said her daughter. Yes, Jessalyn nodded, and somne pine after. I believe we've both in the shop, Jenelaine said. Shall I check? Do, and hand over that alley piece while you're back there. Jenelaine passed the crossbow to her mother, then unlocked the door at the rear of the room and disappeared, closing it behind her once again. Jessalyn set the weapon gently down atop the counter, keeping one long-fingered hand on the tiller.
"You wound us, madam," said Carlo. "We're harmless as kittens."
"More so," said Galdo. "Kittens have claws and piss on things indiscriminately."
"It's not just you, boys. It's the city. Whole place is like the boil, what with Nazca getting clipped. Old Barsavi's got to have some retribution in the works. God knows who this grey king is or what he wants, but I'm more worried by the day for what might come up my stairs."
"It's a messy time," said Carlo.
Jenelaine returned with two small pouches in her hands. She locked the door behind her, passed the pouches to her mother, and picked up the crossbow once again. "Well," said the elder Dobar, "here's what it is, then. Your friend takes this, the red pouch. It's barrel robber's blossom, a sort of purple powder. In the red pouch, remember. Put it in water. It's an emetic, if the word means anything to you."
"Nothing pleasant," said Galdo.
5 minutes after he drinks it, he gets an ache in the belly. 10 minutes, and he gets wobbly at the knees. 15 minutes, and he starts vomiting up every meal he's had for the past week. Won't be pretty. Have buckets close at hand."
"And it'll look absolutely real?" asked Carlo.
"Look. Sweetmeat, it'll be as real as it gets. You ever see anyone feign vomiting?"
"Yes," said the Sansas in perfect unison. "He does this thing with chewed-up oranges," added Galdo.
"Well, your friend won't be feigning this. Any physicker in Camor would swear it was a real and natural distress. You can't even see the barrel robber's blossom once it comes up. It is..."